Hello, I'm Tony Ryan in Adelaide, South Australia, with a series of interviews with contributors to New Male Studies, Volume 1, Issue 1, January 2012. It's available online, www.newmalestudies.com. In this interview, I'm speaking with Los Angeles-based author, parent and teacher, Malina Saval. We began our conversation talking about her book, The Secret Lives of Boys, and then about her son, Boaz, or Bo, the subject of her article in the first edition of New Male Studies, Boaz Behaving Badly. I spoke with her via Skype in December 2011. Malina Saval, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What led you to research and then write about The Secret Life of Boys?
Basically, the idea for the book came when I was teaching a class part-time. This was in 2005. I was teaching at a Hebrew school here in Los Angeles a couple of days a week. And one of my teaching assistants was a boy. He was 14 when I met him, and he just recently gotten out of a drug rehab center where he was for addiction to methamphetamine. And, you know, we became really close. I became kind of his mentor. And as I learned about him and his experiences, I thought, wow, well, for starters, he was really mature and seemed to know so many things about life that I don't know if a lot of adults assumed that teenagers knew. He seemed really smart, really self-aware, and was just an interesting person. And I became close with his mom. And we would go over there for dinners. And one night we were all out at a play. My fiance at the time, who's now my husband, and this particular boy, his name is Lee. I'm sure he wouldn't mind if I mentioned his name, especially since you're in Australia. So what are the odds of anybody knowing him? So Lee, we all were hanging out. We went to this play. And that night and the play was actually about a woman that was coming to terms with her own cocaine addiction. And he really took to the play. He really identified with a lot of its themes. And afterwards, we were just saying, wow, it'd be really cool to write an article about boys. And we were going to call it Finding Emo, which is kind of a play on the movie Finding Nemo. And emo is short for emotional, and it's kind of a word used to describe a particular kind of teenager, wears black a lot, listens to alternative music. Is kind of mopey, you know, and all these things that go along with the word emotional. And so we just thought it would be a fun play on words. And the title didn't stick, and we changed it to The Secret Lives of Boys. But that was kind of the first night that the idea to write about boys really kind of came to me. And from there, I wrote an article about teenage boys in Los Angeles, and it was a cover story for the LA Weekly. And after I wrote that story for the LA Weekly, it was about a 6,000-word piece, and it came out in January of 2006. And then I was talking to my book agent about a project that I thought would make a great book, and it was the book about boys. So I went about and I wrote a 60, 70-page outline, and my idea was to expand the study of boys to the national level. And once the book was sold, I was then able to contact different places all over the country, different schools, different youth organizations, and get a list of different boys that I could interview and talk to and write about them.
And so you ended up with 10 boys, and it's these 10 boys that gave you their story, and it's on their stories that this book is based.
Yeah, I wanted to start out with a lot more than 10, but for certain obvious reasons, space, time, I chose the 10 boys that I thought really represented a good cross-section of teenage boys in America. There were a couple of boys whose parents really weren't so happy about the project. They were a little scared, and so they kind of dropped out of the project, and then I had to find a couple to fill in for them. Most of the parents were really excited about it and encouraging and supportive. And some of the parents really weren't even in the picture. So they kind of weren't a problem because they weren't even around. But I ended up with these 10, and they, you know, come from all different walks of life. There's young Muslim teenager. There's a boy who was hearing impaired and also gay and also a vegan and also a Republican. And he kind of debunked a lot of stereotypes one would have about gay teens in America. There was a boy that lived in New York City and he was wealthy and he had obsessive compulsive disorder. So he talked about his struggle. So there were all different kinds of kids. I spent time with them, was kind of in the foxhole with them, so to speak. And we went to concerts and went out to dinner. And I wanted this book to be really about, mainly about their voice and giving them a chance to talk about what it feels like to them to be young and male in America. And also to talk about the juxtaposition between what their lives are like and what their parents think their lives are like. I'm just talk about the differences between the way they see themselves and the way society sees them. So that was kind of one of the main themes that I was working with, and also just to ask them questions that a lot of people hadn't really asked them. I think a lot of times adults really assumed that they knew what these kids needed and what was going on in their lives, but they hadn't even really asked straight up what is going on with you. And they hadn't really admitted that they didn't know. And they were coming from a position not of knowledge, but of, you know, just kind of guessing what was going on. And the teens that I spoke to really responded when parents or teachers or even friends said, look, I don't really know how to help you. I'm not sure. I'm confused myself. My life isn't perfect. So maybe we should work together and try to figure this problem, whatever it might be, out. They really responded to that more than somebody coming to them and saying, oh, I know what it's like to be young. I was there once. I know it all. I understand. I'm experienced. I can answer and I can solve all your problems. Just listen to me and everything will be fine. Because that's definitely not true. And actually, as quote unquote grown up, although I don't quite feel that way a lot of the times, I don't know all the answers and I don't think anybody does. And if we did, there would be no point to even moving on with our lives. If we had everything figured out, there'd be no room for growth. So these kids were really self-aware and really were receptive to people admitting that they didn't know everything and that they were kind of looking to learn from these kids and kind of together go on a journey of discovery and you know, figuring things out, learning together. It sounds kind of cheesy, but it was true in my experience with these kids. And I still talk to some of these kids too. There's a few and they pop in and out and we're on Facebook, you know, we're Facebook friends. So I know where they've come and it's just amazing to see how they've grown. And, you know, also it's not without some sort of tragedy. There was also a boy in my book who actually passed away. And I guess one would have to read the book to really understand this boy, or at least a little bit of him, but he was, he had a lot of behavioral problems, psychological problems. He was incredibly bright. He, you know, we'll never know the whole story, but he had dabbled in drugs and the cause of death was, according to his parents, an accidental overdose. So, you know, kind of a heavy burden too, to have written about a boy and essentially, you know, immortalized him in the form of a book, and he's, you know, not here anymore. And he had spoken a lot about how he didn't really think he would live to see old age. It's kind of like any other cross section of life. You have people that do really well and people, unfortunately, that don't do so well, and a little bit of everything in between. Across the board, these boys were just full of insight. They really valued their friendships. You know, I would say across the board, I got a picture of boys that for whom friendship was really, really, really important. They were really loyal to their friends. They valued them tremendously. And if one of their friends betrayed them, it really cut deep. They were incredibly honest. They were really funny, really funny. They just had kind of a mature understanding of life and relationships and their parents' relationships. And they were lonely a lot of the times. You know, what was very on trend, especially when I started to write this book, is that boys are not emotional, which is just, I mean, it's almost so stupid to even put it out there. And they are emotional. They do cry. They have a lot of feelings. They're very romantic. That was one thing that I found. A lot of these boys really wanted to find some sort of romantic relationship. They wrote love letters. They made mixed CDs for girlfriends. And they were just really interesting people like everybody else.
But those words of yours in the book
steeped in loneliness. It really struck me. And I guess we can all think back to our own growing up. I also thought of this day and age where so many young people are using social media to build up friendships. And we could talk about that. I think that's maybe a separate issue for today.
Yeah.
But that whole question of loneliness just struck me.
And I don't know the answer to this, but it just seems like with the more social outlets we have, the lonelier I think society can become, because you can hide behind a computer. There's nothing forcing you to get together for coffee with anybody these days. Really, I mean, one could possibly go weeks with just being at home and quote unquote having these like ambient friendships, you know, getting a little off track. But yeah, there was a lot of loneliness, and I think a lot of it could be kind of eased if these boys, if we know we do more to encourage friendships between these different boys and so forth, so that they could really understand that they are not the only ones out there.
You talk about the importance of friendships, particularly in the dark times, and those friendships having the potential to keep boys afloat. Again, they're very strong words.
Yeah, well, I mean, I saw it firsthand. I heard about it firsthand. I saw it in action. I saw that these boys, a lot of whom had really serious grown-up, quote-unquote grown-up problems, and they had these friendships, and without them, I don't know what would have happened to them. You know, there was this one particular boy, the wealthy boy from New York City, who had obsessive-compulsive disorder, and he'd struggled with this demon for so long. And he had a really good friend that really was there for him when his parents, not even when his parents weren't there for him, but when he felt that he couldn't go to his parents. I think that's another thing. I think, you know, a child is not always going to go to their parent. I always don't go to my parent. I rarely go to my parents. It's, you know, I mean, it depends on what the issue is. So I think it's also important to tell parents, find your child, help in any way you can to get him in a group, introduce him to the right kind of friends, mentors, an older brother figure, what have you, so that when there are problems, you're not going to be able to be there for your kid. You cannot be there all the time. You have to be a parent, but sometimes a kid needs a friend. So it's really important to help boys find other boys that they can confide in. And, you know, so what if you can't tell your parent one thing that's going on? So long as you can tell somebody else that you can trust. For these boys that I met, it was really, really critical in their lives.
What are we as parents, adults, teachers not doing right when it comes to boys?
When I wrote the book, I had a baby. He was a child. I mean, he was like, I literally sold the idea for this book when I was about almost like at the end of my pregnancy. So when I wrote the book, I was dealing with an infant. Now that infant is 5 years old, and I'm increasingly getting an understanding of what boys are like and how they're collectively thought of in society. So what I'm saying is firsthand, I know the job of being a parent is incredibly difficult and challenging. And so I don't lay any sort of blame in general on parents. I mean, some parents are not the best parents, but a lot of parents probably are great parents. When I think of things we can do to help boys, I think number one, ask them more questions and don't go to them with the assumption that you know everything going on. Number two, I think that in the educational system, I think so much of it is designed for girls. It's really female oriented. Sit in your seat, keep your hands crossed. And boys generally don't learn, most boys do not learn that way. And then if they don't learn that way, they are kind of a lot of times stigmatized or given some sort of diagnoses for this or that when really they're just being completely normal. I think definitely asking them questions, don't assume you know what's going on in their lives, admit that you don't know what's going on and that you're not perfect too. That was kind of the big one. And yeah, I think the friendship is a huge thing. I think really helping kids to develop and foster friendships with other boys is another big one. I mean, there are just so many things.
I'm Tony Ryan in Adelaide, South Australia, and I'm in conversation today with Los Angeles-based author and parent Melina Saval. Melina has written an article in the first edition of New Male Studies. And Melina, the article is about your son. Tell me about Bo.
Boaz, we call him Bo. He's 5 years old. Gosh, this is actually a tougher one to talk about than my book. He's 5 years old. He's in preschool. He's in his fourth year of preschool. He did not go to kindergarten. Here in the States, they typically, a child typically goes to kindergarten when they're five. but a lot of his teachers and the director of his preschool and we, his, you know, my husband and I decided that he could probably benefit from one more year of preschool. I mean, it's so hard to encapsulate, you know, who he is. It's kind of like asking one to define, well, what's life? You know, it's like, well, I can talk about his ear or his hand maybe, but he's been diagnosed with a lot of different things from sensory integration dysfunction, auditory processing disorder. He's been in speech therapy. He's been in occupational therapy for both of those things. And, you know, the definitions of what, let's say, sensory integration dysfunction, there's so many different aspects of it and different, you know, a list of criteria for it. But basically, so moving away from the diagnoses, because it gets kind of confusing. And half the time, I don't even know if I believe in the diagnoses. And half the time, the people giving the diagnoses, I don't even think they understand what they're talking about. Or it can get very, very confusing with different doctors saying different things and bringing in my son for one evaluation and then literally getting a call 2 hours later from another doctor saying that they disagree with what the doctor you just saw said. It's very confusing. So I think staying away from all those labels, this is sort of about Bo in a nutshell. Boaz, when he was two, didn't really have many words, and that's when he was tested for speech and language delay. So that's when he started speech therapy. And then about a year and a half later, it was clear that he had all these other issues, tantrums, really difficult time with transitions, screaming fits, difficult sleeping, obstinate behavior, freakouts about nothing, very rigid sort of behavior. If things didn't go the way that he wanted, he would fixate on a certain idea. If he wanted to do something and you tried to even bribe him with other things like, okay, we can't do that, but we'll do something else. We can't go to the carousel today, but, you know, we can go to the park. But he, you know, it's just one of those kids, you know, kind of a so-called problem child is the easiest way to kind of define him by, you know, an outside. If I were an outsider, I would look at this kid and I would, now I wouldn't because I have a kid like that. But before I had kids, you know, I might look at him and say, oh, he's a handful. You know, he's just, he's really difficult to contain and control. And he refuses to do anything he doesn't like to do. And there's just high levels of frustration, challenges and socialization. And so now he's going, well, he's still five. He's five and a half. And so now the goal is us to figure out where he can go to school in the fall. That's going to be a nurturing kind of environment for him where he thrives. Because cognitively, he's all there. But behaviorally, it's difficult to get him to a place where he can kind of calmly sit still and absorb information because that's not the way he learns. He's a very out-of-the-box kid. And in the States, there's a lot of education is structured for that kid who fits in the box. And if your kid doesn't fit in the box, you're kind of faced with the challenge of where to send him to school, finding a place. So that's kind of where we are today, figuring out where he's going to go next year.
I think many parents listening to this would identify with that 4- and 5-year-old issue, but I think they'd also identify with your comment about the trial and error of diagnoses.
See, now I'm in kind of two different places. I read a lot, I research a lot. When I started out this quote-unquote process of figuring out what is wrong with Boaz, I was very open to diagnoses. I think I even talk about this in my essay. When you're given a diagnosis and you have a child that's really difficult, a lot of times diagnoses come as a relief because, oh, we found out what the problem is. Now we can fix it. Little did I know that that one diagnosis would turn into two, would turn into three, would turn into four, would turn into this whole different, you know, roster of various different people, experts, from social workers to therapists to speech pathologists to medical doctors, you know, all these different people kind of getting on their soapbox, as it were, and kind of putting in their two cents about what's going on. So instead of me feeling relieved at these diagnoses, I've now come to a point where not only am I thoroughly confused, but I'm starting to realize that labels are pointless. They really are. It's more about finding techniques and therapeutic tools that work with each child. So it's not so important whether or not my son is diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. It doesn't really matter. You know, there's more and more evidence that the increase in diagnoses of autism spectrum like disorders in children, those numbers might actually, in boys, might actually be inflated for various different because of various different factors. Again, this, I'm not an expert in autism whatsoever, but just based on what I've read, and also there's been this whole series of articles in the Los Angeles Times, which just came out, and one fact was really, really interesting. Generally, autism disorders are the percentage of autism disorders that are diagnosed increases in a wealthier, more affluent environment because, you know, people are taking their kids to doctors. Also, in order sometimes, and I can identify with this, in order to get services through the state, it benefits a parent to get some sort of diagnosis because then they can get the benefits offered to them that otherwise they might not be able to afford. So sometimes you want a diagnosis because then your kid can get the therapy that he or she probably needs. So I don't know. I kind of go back and forth. Sometimes I think there's nothing wrong with Boaz, and the only problem is that basically he's in an environment that does not know how to deal with him, and it's their lack of understanding. And then other times I really do feel like he has issues for whatever reason. He is having a difficult time adapting to the current structure of his educational setting. And so it is really important to find a place where he can learn how he best learns. And he is not going to sit still in a class for story time. He loves stories, but he has to sit in the corner of the room and listen to it separately. And sometimes he has to rock back and forth to comfort himself. And sometimes he's going to pitch fits, which for seemingly no reason at all. And that's how his body's regulating. His social skills definitely leave a lot to be desired. But he's, you know, one of the smartest, most affectionate, polite children that I've really met. He loves animals. He loves horses. He loves our dog. So he's just a really interesting kid. He's not fitting the mold. That's just the easiest way of saying it. And in the States, if you're not fitting the mold, you kind of have to create your own mold. And it's difficult and can be expensive and can be frustrating because you'll see a lot of different doctors. We've been to so many assessments, and after a while, it just becomes sort of not productive and not really therapeutic because A, the child does not want to keep going through these. I mean, it's the same as anyone else. If somebody said, okay, play with the blocks in the floor, answer these questions, you get thoroughly annoyed, especially when you know the answers. So that's where we kind of are with him. He's sort of putting his foot down and being really resistant to a lot of these evaluations. So I think we're going to take a little break, but I will say it's kind of a full-time job dealing with someone like Boaz. And it's talk about loneliness. You often feel that you're in this a lot, you know, all alone, and that nobody is on your side. And, you know, sometimes I'll go to meet with a doctor and you'll sit down with them and they'll talk to you about your child as though they're presenting you with helpful information. And really all they're doing is telling you what you already know. So that's another frustrating thing as a parent. It's kind of increasingly difficult for me to keep my cool. I mean, without tooting my own horn, it's like, okay, I've written a book about boys. I just wrote an essay about my kid. I mean, I'm clearly somebody that has some awareness of what's going on with my child. Like, hello. And you're looking for someone to say something that completely sheds light, and it's going to just, you know, you want someone to come into the room. Here's where you should go to school. Perfect environment. But for boys, you're never going to, for kids in general, for anybody, you're never going to find something that gives you everything. So ultimately, when you have a child that is really difficult and is challenging in so many ways, you kind of have to carve out your own sort of place and know that you might get a lot of what you need, but there's always going to be something you're not, and you have to create that for yourself. You know, I don't know. I mean, Boaz, like I said, he loves riding ponies. So that's something we do where that really calms him down. You just have to really make an effort to find things that your child can do easily and makes him feel good about himself.
Melina, I have to say that there's a great photograph of your son at the beginning of your article.
Oh, thank you.
A great, great five-year-old. And in fact, end of your article, you write about his future. You say he'll get his driver's license in his final year of school, and then he'll go on to do great things. Yet he's only just five at the moment. It's great that you've got that really positive view of the future, even though these challenges are facing you at the moment. But you are confident about his future.
I think so, yeah. I mean, you know, also I needed a really nice, lovely ending for my essay. So, it just sounded really good to kind of end on. Who knows? You know, one never knows. I think you just have to stay in the day, you know, I think that's the most important thing, is to not project and just to stay in the moment. And even myself, sometimes I calm myself down and I'm so worried, where's he going to go to school next year? And then I remember, it's only kindergarten. My own personal belief is that it's not the most important thing in the world where he ends up next year. It might be a bit of an experiment. You know, it might be we choose a school and it doesn't work out. And you just kind of have to embrace the unknown. You know, it might work out beautifully and you just don't know. And all you can really have control over is today, you know. And I think as a parent, as a person, that's probably the best advice, you know, I could possibly give any parent raising a boy, is just stay in the day, stay in the moment, and be your child's advocate. At the end of the day, you have to go with your gut. You're going to get a lot of feedback and a lot of advice, and most of it will probably not be helpful. But take whatever kernel that might be helpful, and then, you know what, don't be afraid to make your own choices based on what you think your child needs. You know, no one else is going to know your kid better than yourself. So, you know, and doctors don't know everything. They really don't. So
that's a great note on which to end our interview. Melina Saval, I thank you very much indeed for your time talking to me today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I so appreciate it. It was a really great time. Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Los Angeles-based author, teacher, and parent Melina Saval about her article, Boaz Behaving Badly. Her website is melinasaval.com. That's melinasaval.com. Melina Saval's article is published in New Male Studies, Volume 1, Issue 1, January 2012. It's available online, www.newmalestudies.com. That's newmalestudies.com. In Adelaide, South Australia, I'm Tony Ryan.